Chapter 6. What We Give and Receive. Trust and Admiration. Sometimes, sex with a long-term partner happens spontaneously. But most of the time it happens on purpose, which means that sex will require that you communicate about plans, obstacles, and pleasures with your partner. Fortunately, you already communicate about all kinds of practical things with your partner. You may communicate about work hours, meals, chores, kids, coordinating time with other partners, other friends, other family. And those conversations aren't always easy and unemotional. People have feelings about work hours, meals, chores, kids, and time with other people. If you can have those conversations, you can learn to have sex conversations. But if communicating about sex were the same as communicating about all those other potentially heavy topics, I would not need to devote a third of this book to it. Because of the damage done to us by cultural lies, on these much more in chapters 9 and 10, many of us feel like it's easier to have sex with someone than it is to talk about it with them. This chapter will help you get to the having sex part more easily by explaining the relationship characteristics that make it easier to talk about sex. Whether a relationship is sexually exclusive or not, regardless of the genders of the people involved, there are some basic, necessary dynamics that make it easier for each person to participate in cultivating a shared garden. In this chapter, I'll talk about two relationship characteristics that are crucial. They are admiration and trust. Admiration. What are some of your favorite things about your partner? When do you most enjoy their company? What makes you proud to be their partner? In chapter 2, I suggested we all only ever have sex we like. Here, I want to suggest that we all only ever have sex with people we like. Sound obvious? Stay with me. A therapist at a workshop asked me what I would suggest for a couple that was choosing to stay together for the kids, though they don't like each other. They agreed that they didn't like each other, yet they still wanted to have sex. I was baffled at first. I asked, why would they want to have sex with someone they don't like? Well, that's a good question, the therapist answered, and she wasn't being facetious. She had been working with the couple's assumption that the husband in particular deserved sex, but if he was still married for the kids, then his wife, whom he disliked, was his only source of sex, so they needed to find a way to have acceptable sex with someone they disliked. I offered the only advice that seemed ethical to me. If spouses dislike each other to the point of just waiting until the kids are out of the house before they split up, they're also waiting to have sex they'll enjoy until the kids are out of the house. If both partners show up to their erotic garden and they both think, ugh, this asshole again, when they see their partner, I understand that they might manage to have some kind of sex, but how can they have sex that's actually worth the time and effort? The world would be a better place if we all only ever had sex with people we like. Being able to look at your partner and see them as admirable, even when you may be in a difficult emotional space like rage or fear or panic grief, is essential to co-creating a satisfying long-term sexual relationship. In a way, what I'm suggesting here is extremely basic and obvious, right? You have to like each other most of the time. But also, it's a radical shift in priorities. I'm replacing passion and spontaneous desire and being in love with the seemingly tepid emotion of admiration. It takes me back to the myth that rage and lust can coexist in a functional long-term sexual connection. We have been taught that somehow intensity matters more than valence. That is, the sheer quantity of emotion is more important than whether that emotion feels good or bad. Certainly, there are people who have experienced and even aspire to feeling passionately in love with their partner without regard to whether they admire that person. Whenever you find yourself prioritizing passion over admiration, remember, the most common thing people want and like when they have sex is connection. You can have sex with someone you don't admire, of course you can. But if you want to sustain a multi-decade sexual connection with someone, why connect over and over with someone you don't admire? Won't you just feel more and more alone as you reinforce the lack of emotional engagement between you? Admiration is a great benchmark for choosing a partner in the first place. And for those who share a household with a partner, admiration is a great tool for getting through the inevitable rough patches. When we are stressed, our brains are more prone to noticing the things that annoy and frustrate us and ignoring the things that please or impress us. If you're exhausted and irritable and your partner brings you flowers, your brain might think, sure, like flowers are going to help the situation. Whereas when you're rested and calm and your partner brings you flowers, your brain is more likely to think, flowers! My partner thought about me when I wasn't with them and they went out of their way to bring me a gift. When you are stressed, remember that you chose this person, maybe even to the exclusion of all other sex partners. Surely there was a reason for that. Admiration is an important component of a sexual relationship that you would like to last decades because, honestly, why bother talking to each other about your emotional floor plans or about what you want and like when you want and like sex or about your brakes and accelerator if you don't admire the person with whom you're collaborating to create that shared sexual connection? If you sometimes, or often, can't find much to admire about your partner, don't despair. You are not alone. It's so easy to forget to admire our partners in the midst of the hullabaloo and frenetic planning, scheduling, and can you please just run the laundry of daily life. And there are evidence-based ways to strengthen your sense of admiration in your relationship. Here are two. The first is an exercise I learned when I dragged my spouse to a Hold Me Tight weekend workshop based on Sue Johnson's Emotionally Focused Therapy, EFT. 10 out of 10, by the way. Highly recommend. It was John Gottman's I Appreciate adjective checklist. It's a literal list of positive adjectives, and our job was to select a few that were even slightly characteristic of our partner, even if there was only one instance of this characteristic. Notice how gently this language prods couples in the direction of noticing the good stuff, since partners might be doing this exercise while they're in the midst of a lot of conflict. When you consider your partner, maybe the first thing you'll think of is all the things you resent, all the complaints you have. Set that aside for a few minutes and instead consider some characteristics about your partner that you appreciate. Here's a second exercise that can help. Think of something about your partner that drives you up the wall. The first time you try this, choose something that drives you up a very small wall. Leave the makes me question my life choices problems for when you've got more practice. Then consider what trait underlies that behavior and think of a way that same trait shows up positively in your relationship. For example, I joke with my partner that I am perfect. My perfection lies in my imperfections. What I mean is, all the best things about me are inextricably tied to the worst things about me. By worst, of course, I mean all the things I'm most inclined to beat myself up for. Do I forget important dates, ignore household tasks, fail to express gratitude to him for picking up all the slack I leave? I do. Do I also have intensely focused attention that lets me do stuff like write books, stay finely tuned to him when we're in an erotic place, and learn new things to make our lives better? I do. And all of those things are tied together. I wouldn't trade my intense focus for anything. But I also feel bad when I forget important tasks. The same goes for him. Some of his best traits, his loyalty and kindness and reliability and humor and sensitivity, are inextricably tied to the ways he sometimes struggles. He's the clutterbug in the family because he's loyal to any object that enters the house. He'll do anything I ask because he is kind, but I can't just say, "Hey, I need this thing." He benefits when I pad my request in tenderness and light because he is sensitive. The emotional labor he requires of me feels entirely worth it because his sensitivity is one of my favorite things about him. Try reframing a partner's imperfections, flaws, or shortcomings in terms of a link to that partner's greatest attributes. Stubborn becomes persistent. Unfocused becomes free-thinking, creative. Demanding becomes believing we deserve the best together. All the best, closest to perfection traits about you are linked to the most difficult traits about you, too. Exercises like these develop what therapist Sara Nasirzadeh calls emergent love, love that emerges through shared experience. They are why I fall more in love, whatever the heck that even is, with my person every year. As we struggle together through whatever vicissitudes life offers, we learn each other's strengths and needs better and better. We support each other according to our own strengths, and we acknowledge our needs more and more fluidly. I've offered two ways to enhance mutual admiration in your relationship, but let's spend a moment addressing a challenge therapist and author Terence Real calls normal marital hatred. It happens when a trait that may have been charmingly quirky at the start of the relationship becomes intensely irritating. It's often the result of having to live with the charming quirk day after day, month after month, year after year. Maybe you roll your eyes at the way your partner makes the bed. Maybe you can't take the way they channel surf or let a show run continuously on streaming even when they're not watching anymore. Admiration is an inoculation against the irritation, so you can avoid the escalation of these mundane irritations into full-blown hate. It gives you practice at remembering the good things about your partner, even when you're confronted with the not-so-good things. For example, I interrupt my spouse. Like, a lot. At least once a day. I feel like I know his mind so well that I know what he's going to say, so I skip ahead to my answer before he gets his thought out. It's very irritating of me. Fortunately, he knows that my rudeness is a product of the same traits he finds admirable in me, like my quickness of mind and my deep sense of connection with his thought process. Without the admiration, it might be easy to assign some other meaning to the quirk. He could decide that I'm doing it to annoy him. He could wonder if I'm deliberately disrespecting him or don't have enough patience with him even to let him finish a sentence. He could turn it into a power struggle. But in reality, it's just a less than thrilling part of what it means to share a home with me, a person he admires, trusts, and loves so much. Other tools beyond admiration can help too. Hatred lives in the rage space of your emotional floor plan, so you can process the flash of rage when you know how to move yourself out of the rage space. In fact, my simple definition of hatred is that it's rage motivation to destroy something that is in your way, standing between you and some goal you're moving toward, like the goal of finishing a sentence. Now, people have a lot of feelings about the word hate. There are a lot of shoulds around it, which makes the phrase normal marital hatred seem really flashy. We're not supposed to hate people, especially not people we love. Feel free to replace hate in your mind with frustration or irritation or annoyance. But all of those emotions live in the rage space, which means a tool you already have that can help you is simply knowing how you move yourself through the rage space into a different space. But if the interrupting or the sexual difficulty becomes a character in a larger story about respect or power or trust, it feeds our sense that the interrupting or sexual difficulty is symbolic of some relationship-threatening problem. Just as interruptions cannot, on their own, end a long-term committed relationship, sexual difficulties can't either. It's when we wield the interruption or sex problem as proof that there is something fundamentally intolerable about our partner that we begin to spiral away from normal hatred or irritation into a darker place. Even in my relationship with confident hair flip, genuinely superb communication, we can't always reach each other. But there's something we always do right. We can laugh at us. For example, here's another way I am so irritating. The highly focused attention that helps me write big books also means that sometimes when my beloved spouse talks to me, I do not hear him. And when I do hear him, I can pay attention for a couple of minutes before my attention is tugged back to whatever I was focused on, and I've tuned him out again. Do I try to keep my attention on him when he needs it? I absolutely do. But sometimes my brain just can't disengage from what I'm doing. People vary. He has developed playful strategies for managing me. Sometimes he counts how many times he says what he wants to say before I notice he's there. And then he says it again. "Have you been there long?" I'll ask if he seems to be suppressing giggles. Or sometimes he'll begin the conversation with total nonsense until I notice that he's talking. "Have you ever thought about how delicious pizza would be if cheese was on the bottom?" is a real example of something he has said that I did not hear. He told me about it when I asked him for an example just now. And that's my third trick. The first was to recall how the quirk is related to the things you admire about the person. The second is to remember how you move through the rage space. And third, when you're outside of rage, go to play. Just as it would be easy to assign meaning to frequent interruption, it would also be so easy for him to take my highly focused attention personally. It would be so easy for him to start telling himself a story that it's impossible that I genuinely do not hear him. I must be ignoring him on purpose. I'm being rude, disrespectful. Instead, he thinks it's hilarious. How can a person so smart and responsive be so truly oblivious? Intense experiences of anger are rarely funny in the moment, but often, after the fact, if we can stop taking ourselves so seriously, it can be hilarious. If you're thinking, "But it's not funny, it's serious," then it's not just normal marital hatred. It's a conflict about something outside the scope of a book about sex in a long-term relationship. We love our people for all the things they are and all the things they aren't. We celebrate the things they are, and we laugh over the things they aren't. Amma and I. Amma and I might seem like an odd fit on the surface. Amma is Black, from a pretty affluent family, spiritual, and approaching her 40th birthday. Dai is nearly 50, white, raised in poverty, secular, and autistic. They met online 15 years ago on a message board discussing the works of Octavia Butler. Dai was diagnosed with autism, ASD level 1, in her late 30s, when Amma, then an anonymous internet message board friend, suggested she might be on the spectrum. Perhaps a giveaway, it did not occur to Dai to be offended by the suggestion. She just scheduled the appointments, got the diagnosis, and then spent a solid year reevaluating the meaning of everything that had ever happened in her life. Dai drives Amma bonkers sometimes in ways they attribute to Dai's neurodivergence. For example, anytime inflation makes her grocery budget unviable, Dai goes through a period of mentioning how much each item used to cost when she was a kid. A box of mac and cheese costs a quarter, she said, as her wife picked up the organic kind with extra fiber and pasta shaped like animals, even though it costs six times as much as the store brand kind right next to it. Amma and I both had good incomes. They could afford what Amma called food food. Di knew this. She didn't mention the prices because she was worried about money. She said these things because it's part of her brain's process of rewriting her inner understanding of the food budget. A can of tuna costs like a quarter, she mentioned as she scanned unit prices and Amma picked up the line-caught solid white tuna in oil. We're paying for more than full bellies, Amma replied unnecessarily. It's also the environment and the nutritional value, and I know, honey, I agree with our choices, she said. And later, eggs were 70 cents a dozen. From battery farms with inhumane conditions sold in those styrofoam containers that will exist until the end of time. I know, I agree, this is better. Ground beef was a dollar a pound. Normal. Marital hatred. Di had never experienced it and didn't understand it when Amma brought it up. You hate me? Di asked, bewildered. No, I would never use the word hate to describe what it feels like. I just have a little rush of annoyance or frustration each time you talk about food prices. But sometimes it floods, like when there's been a lot of rain but everything is fine, until one day it's not and suddenly the basement is underwater. Di nodded, trying to understand. You want me to stop talking about grocery prices when I redo the budget? Yes, that would be nice, Amma said. But really, I want you to understand what it feels like to me when you do it. Di nodded some more, but said, what does it feel like? It feels... And remember, I know this is not your intention. I know it's just in your brain clicking away, but it feels like you're shaming us for not prioritizing frugality over other variables when we make food choices. It feels like you're flashing your childhood poverty in my face instead of simply appreciating that we are in a position to prioritize environmental variables and nutritional variables and even just flavor preferences over how much something costs. All that from me just saying historical prices? Yeah, all that. It's a lot. And again, I know it's not your intention. It's just how it lands for me. Heard, love. Should I try to write it down instead of saying it out loud? That would be great. This is one simple strategy for addressing the small things that can generate big feelings. Amma explained what the small behavior felt like, the meaning that her own internal experience imposed on Di's words. She felt understood by Di, and Di recognized the importance of shifting this small behavior. She looked for simple ways to make space for what Amma needed. Sometimes she did need to say it out loud, though, but she found she could say it to her older kids, who rolled their eyes, but hey, they learned a little about mom and a lot about inflation and wage stagnation in the face of growing income inequality. The takeaway here is that they have the same dynamic when it comes to talking about sexuality. Remember their conversation in the shower when Amma told Di she realized that what she liked was playfulness and teasing? And Di did that, and it worked? When you can ask for what you need in a way that's clear to the person receiving the request, problems get solved without resentment or defensiveness. And that sure is a lot easier if you admire your partner instead of believing the stories your mind creates about why a person might be doing something that drives you bonkers. Trust. The most evidence-based couples therapies put trust at the center of their programs for good reason. Trust is so much the foundation of any connection that the absence of trust is essentially the absence of connection. So what the heck is trust? How do you build it? And how do you repair it when there's a betrayal? Researcher and therapist Sue Johnson breaks down trust to the question, are you there for me? Are stands for emotionally accessible, emotionally responsive, and emotionally engaged. Notice that trust is emotional, not intellectual. It's not a rational decision. It's an emotional dynamic between and among people. It's about being there for your partner, not just physically, but with your heart. When you're asking yourself about the trust in your relationship, powerful questions to begin with are, am I there for my partner? And is my partner there for me? Are you emotionally present for each other? Underlying this dynamic of being emotionally there, accessible, responsive, and engaged for our partners is our willingness to bear some cost in order to benefit our partners and our relationships. In the examples I'll share here, that cost comes mostly in the form of making considerate choices about your communication and allowing moments of difficult emotions, yours or theirs, to be a normal part of a long-term relationship. Emotional accessibility. Sometimes trust is damaged by a specific crisis event, like a betrayal. But more often, emotional accessibility erodes gradually through neglect as partners grow emotionally distant. There are plenty of good reasons why a couple might experience this. The sheer overwhelming demands on our attention from our jobs, our kids, our families, the world in general, may leave little for our partners. Or we may feel so stuck in the adverse emotional spaces of panic, grief, fear, or rage that we can't find a way to transition into emotional presence with our partner. Just as we have to choose to engage erotically with our partner, cordoning off space, time, and energy for it, we have to choose to engage emotionally. Trust eroding overwhelm and stuckness were important ingredients in my own sexual dry spell. My attention was drawn away from my relationship to my work, and as a result, I wasn't there for my partner. He agreed that my work was important and he was able to meet his own needs, and he didn't want to burden me. And I didn't want to burden him. But by the time I had the wherewithal to re-engage, he had gotten into the habit of doing everything for himself, not connecting with me, not collaborating, not burdening me. So had I. And if each of us could meet our own needs autonomously, why would we open back up to trusting each other, relying on each other to be there? Why try sharing the emotional weight we were each carrying when we knew we could each get by independently? The answer to why was, well, we got married because we agreed that the other person would be our main person for the rest of our lives. Though we were still each other's main person, we were disconnected by each person's autonomy. It wasn't that we didn't trust each other. It was that neither of us was willing to take the risk of asking our partner to bear a cost for us. We could just coexist in the same house without asking each other to do the emotional work of being emotionally accessible, which is what differentiates our connection with each other from our connections with anybody else. Our solution was not about repairing trust, but rebuilding trust, remembering to ask our partner to be emotionally accessible to us, despite the fact that it was actually more effortful at first than just coping independently. If you and your partner are roommates rather than partners or lovers, you may have grown into this habit of independently coping and not relying on each other to be emotionally accessible. A good place to start in rebuilding emotional accessibility is John Gottman's stress-reducing conversation technique, where you and your partner spend half an hour every day, 15 minutes each, listening to each other's experiences, especially complaints about other people. The listening partner listens not to solve problems, but to be a cheerleader, to be on the same team as the speaker. Be there for each other emotionally. Practice not coping independently, but daring to cope interdependently. Emotional responsiveness. When partners are struggling with responsiveness, a common culprit is plain old distraction. Our attention is tuned to a screen, or to the kids, or to other friends, or partners, or family, or to work, or to any of the myriad things we have to pay attention to. Because of the cost in effort and time of context switching, we offer our partner a fragment of our attention as we continue to think about something else. But when non-responsiveness accumulates over time, it can escalate into a spiral of resentment. For example, some straight friends of mine, let's call them Jeff and Susan, were trapped in a dynamic of rapidly escalating conflict. In just a few sentences, they could transition from Susan calmly asking Jeff to clean the kitchen to enraged yelling. How did they get there? By failing to be responsive to each other's emotions. Jeff was not emotionally responsive to Susan. Instead of responding to her requests for help, he would ignore her until her requests became so irritating that he responded just so she would be quiet. Thus, Susan learned over many years of his lack of emotional responsiveness that the only way to get his attention was with huge, intense emotion. It wasn't just the kitchen, of course. It was many things. Above all, it was what it meant that he cleaned the kitchen. What such an act of householding symbolized about his sense of investment in their relationship, and she had to yell in order to see him invest even the smallest amount of time and energy. The same dynamic played out in their sex life, with the roles swapped. Susan, resentful and disengaged, would ignore Jeff's bids for sex until his requests grew so persistent, critical, and annoying that she would agree to sex just to make him stop asking. How would you feel if a partner agreed to have sex with you just to shut you up? Wouldn't it be more satisfying if they were enthusiastic rather than resigned? This situation is often treated as comedy, the nagging wife and the lazy husband, the frigid wife and the horny, entitled husband. But in reality, there's nothing funny about it. A loved one's lack of emotional responsiveness is basically a form of torture for humans. In the renowned still face experiment, originally conducted in 1975, mothers were coached not to respond to their infants' interactions and bids for attention. No eye contact, a neutral facial expression, no touch. After just 3 minutes without response from their parent, with repeated attempts to create the usual reciprocal back and forth of parent-infant interaction, the babies grow wary, withdrawn, and sad. They go into panic grief, experiencing a tiny wound to their care space, and also, crucially, experience the hopelessness that comes with losing a sense of self-efficacy. Self-efficacy is an individual sense that they can engage with the world in a way that results in getting their needs met. A simple and familiar example of self-efficacy is knowing you can get a snack from a vending machine. A bag of candy getting stuck in the machine is a reliable source of outrage because the unfairness of it challenges our sense of self-efficacy, like the nagging wife, lazy husband trope. This situation is often treated as comedy, and fair enough, the stakes are low. It's just a bag of candy. But in a sense, the candy isn't just candy, any more than cleaning the kitchen is just cleaning the kitchen. The trapped candy is a symbol of our self-efficacy, our sense that we know how to engage with the world so that our needs are met. So we laugh in recognition at the idea of someone escalating to rage, helplessly attacking an unresponsive machine. But Jeff and Susan were escalating to rage and helplessly attacking their unresponsive spouse. Yet their relationship withstood their spiraling failure of emotional responsiveness. How? Therapy! Yay! They had spent years with non-responsiveness eroding the trust between them. At first, they didn't trust each other enough to believe that the other would truly show up for the project of rebuilding trust. and neither was willing to take the risk of trying when it seemed the other person was unwilling to take the risk of trying. It took the support of a professional to help them grieve the old hurts and practice being there for each other. John Gottman describes this nasty, nasty state where both partners are in an adverse emotional space as the place where the couple's love and fun go to die. In this state, he defines trust as each partner reliably changing their own behavior, even if it costs them something to do it, in order to make it easier for the other person to transition out of their negative emotional space. For example, Jeff learned that when they were stressed and annoyed and bickering, Susan would crack a little joke at her own expense so they could laugh a little, a transition toward play. And she learned that Jeff could pause, take a deep breath, and give her a hug, a transition toward care. He might add some play, saying, "Imagine if we had to get through this with some other loser instead of each other. Ugh." Even if they both still had unresolved difficulties, they would each do a little emotional work, bear a little cost, in order to make it easier for the other person to transition into a better state. Emotional engagement. When partners are emotionally engaged, they turn toward each other's feelings with a warm yes. Just as failures of responsiveness are often about distraction, common failures of emotional engagement are about communication skills, like advice giving instead of active listening, or I'm busy instead of I'm here for you. That's good news, because it means it's not a failure of trust or trustworthiness itself. It's just a matter of practicing the skills of listening to your partner's feelings. When your partner comes to you with a difficult feeling and you offer advice for how to solve the problem that caused it, you're engaging with the problem instead of engaging with your partner and their feelings. And you're allowed to do that, but you're missing an opportunity to enhance emotional engagement and thus develop mutual trust. When you approach your partner to initiate sex and they say a reflexive no because they're busy or not in the mood or they're still resentful from some disagreement you had earlier, they're engaging with the question of having sex right now, even if you're trying to initiate for later tonight or later this week, rather than engaging with your feelings about having sex. They're allowed to do that, but they're missing an opportunity to enhance emotional engagement and thus develop mutual trust. I struggled with this for a long time. I understood the principle of emotional engagement, but it just seemed so inefficient to spend a bunch of time talking about our feelings. Can't we just solve the problem and move on? Can't we just say yes or no without having to talk about why yes or no, or how both of us feel about the yes or no? Then I learned a deeper layer to listening to feelings, a layer that gets less attention. I share it here for everyone who, like me, wants communication to be efficient. Individual differences in temperament is most often studied in children and babies as young as newborns, but it remains pretty stable across a person's whole life. A variety of temperamental traits can affect how intuitively we respond to our partners with emotional engagement rather than with problem solving, criticism, or no. I'm going to describe just one. Adaptability. The temperamental trait of adaptability is about how readily we adjust to changes and transitions. Some people transition readily from task to task, from setting to setting, from role to role. But maybe you've spent your whole life feeling really stressed when you transition from one task to another, no matter how familiar those tasks are, or from one setting to another, or from one role to another. So when your partner presents you with a potential transition, for example, they invite you to have sex, something inside you grinds with resistance just because of the difficulty of transitioning out of whatever state of mind you're currently in into a sexy state of mind. Remember the cost of context switching I mentioned at the end of chapter 3? That cost is higher for you if you're slow to adapt. If you're slow to adapt, your first response to a partner, say initiating sex, isn't necessarily a no or a yes, but a sigh or a groan at the effort you know it will cost you to stop watching this television show and start moving toward the lust room, even though in the past, you've almost always been really glad you made the effort. People who take more time to adapt prefer to have a plan, feel comfortable with routines, and like to know what's going to happen ahead of time. They might be people to whom the idea of scheduled sex is naturally appealing. Yes, let's put it in the calendar. What they might not recognize is that they don't need to schedule just the sex. They need to schedule the transition into sex, shifting from work mode or parent mode or hobby mode to lust mode. Takes time and energy, as you learned in Chapter 3 with your emotional floor plan. Your necessary skill is learn what helps you transition. What do you do to disengage from one mode to another, from one task to another? You have successfully done it in a variety of areas in your life, so you know you can do it in this area too. Maybe you use music to transition, or a bath, or a change of clothes. Maybe it's being playful about your struggles with transitions. Maybe you flop dramatically on the sofa and say, "I can't. A dragon came by just now. It was pretty amazing. I'm sorry you missed it, but it cast a spell and turned me into this blob of jelly. You have to roll me off the couch and into the bedroom." Partners of people who are slow to adapt can know not to take it personally. Some people just adapt more slowly than others and benefit from more structure around transitions. In a partnership where one person makes transitions much more gradually than the other, emotional engagement happens when the faster partner expresses support instead of impatience or judgment during the transition. In a sense, the faster to adapt partner bears a small cost of patience and adapting to their partner's needs, while the slower to adapt partner bears the small cost of learning and practicing smoother transitions. Emotional engagement is making a plan and helping the slower to adapt partner know what to expect through the creation and protection of a routine. And the beautiful, ironic reality is that the more trust a slow-to-adapt person has in a shared routine, the freer they'll feel to be flexible. If your partner needs more time to adapt than you do, a little advice. There is no speeding them up. Trying to hurry them along will only slow them down. But if you instead adopt the mindset that planning and preparing for sex is part of the fun, like planning a vacation is part of the vacation, an opportunity to daydream about what it will feel like when you get there, then it will be easier for you to enjoy the transition process and frame it as part of the sexy play you share, instead of a chore to get over with before you finally get to the sex part. Trust your partner to transition at their own pace, and they'll trust you in return. For some of us, trust is easy because we learned it early in our families of origin. For others of us, trust is so, so hard. If trust or being trustworthy are difficult for you, you know what I'm going to suggest, right? Therapy. Therapy and books. This stuff is deep and sometimes difficult. But if we're willing to strengthen our psychological foundations, we build a more stable platform from which to launch our erotic explorations. Chapter 6, TLDR. 1. You don't need to want your partner passionately so much as you need to like them, admire them, and believe that they are worth some effort on your part. 2. Trust is essential to a strong relationship, and it is not rational. It is being emotionally there for your partner, being emotionally accessible, emotionally responsive, and emotionally engaged. As researcher and therapist Sue Johnson puts it, are you there for me? 3. Communicating with trust and trustworthiness isn't always efficient, but it is always more effective. Take the time to be emotionally present, especially for difficult feelings, and you'll improve the foundational strength of the relationship. Some good questions. What is easy to admire about my partner? About myself? What might be difficult to admire about my partner, but is inextricably linked to one of their most admirable qualities? If I bring a difficult feeling to my partner, what would their ideal response look like? If my partner brings a difficult feeling to me, what would my ideal response look like? Am I there for my partner, emotionally accessible, responsive, and engaged? Is my partner there for me? When trust feels weakened, what do we do to repair it?